Working now? I think it is. Well, this is the Goldsmith Lecture. It's named in honor of Mr. Derek Goldsmith, who's present in the front row here. Derek Goldsmith is an engineer and an inventor, and someone with a deep interest in the human mind. He's also a very practical man who believes that where there are problems, there are likely to be solutions, though they mayn't, of course, always be quite where you expect to find them. You don't always find the keys under the public street lamps. So knowing that, Derek Goldsmith a year or two ago decided to set up his own street lamp, his own private street lamp, in an area where there was rather little light being cast before, and to establish a research project, now called the Goldsmith Project, on the evolution of the mind with special reference to the emotions. And as part of that project, we hold an annual lecture called the Goldsmith Lecture, which is by the way here today. The first lecture was given last year by Joe Ledoux from New York on fear and the emotional brain, and today we're very fortunate to have Patrick Wall from University College London lecturing on, his title is, well, it's on the emotion of pain, I could say, but his title specifically is Pain, the Science of Suffering. And you may already have noticed that there's a book outside which is just being published with the same title, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. It's an extraordinarily brilliantly written book. Pat Wall probably knows more about the psychology and physiology of pain than anyone else in the world, and I think as testimony to that, one hardly needs any other recommendation than the fact that the World Pain Congress this summer is being held in honor of his life's work. He's, over the last 50 years, also proved himself a brilliant experimentalist, working on the physiology of the pain pathways in the brain and spinal cord. He's also been a great theoretician, developing really the first decent theory of the interaction between the mind and brain in the development and genesis of pain, the so-called gate control theory, which he developed with Ronald Melzack, and perhaps we'll talk about that a little. And besides that, besides being an experimentalist and a theoretician, he's also been a hands-on physician, someone who's directly been of tremendous help to patients by his compassion and understanding. And Derek will also be pleased to hear he's an inventor, perhaps invented the TENS machine, which many of you may know about, in fact, some of the women here particularly may have used to relieve the suffering of childbirth. I've often heard Pat described as by other people as one of their heroes. I think there are probably many people in the world who have been touched by his work, and if they only knew his name, would also describe him as one of their heroes. We're very lucky to have him here tonight, and please welcome.
So, thank you, Nick. Thanks to LSE. Thanks to Mr. Goldsmith. And here I am, talking with a vast title, utter pretentiousness to talk about such a thing, which I couldn't possibly do. So, obviously, I'm going to narrow down somewhat. And I'll start with the first slide, which is this very familiar Descartes picture, which is the classic picture, and even intuitively is what most people feel. And you'll see what it is. There's a stimulus here, and a detector, and a pathway which goes up to the brain. And that pathway is hardwired, it's line labeled, and it's modality specific. And all of those things are completely wrong, even if it feels like that. However, it's had a 250-year run and has produced nothing of any use, but convinced people that's what's going on inside their brains. So it's time for a change. And here I am not talking in context of this department, this place, and the forebears. So if I'm going to talk then a little bit about pain in the context of evolution, now immediately there's a wonderful thing that comes with talking about evolution. Your teleology is permitted. most of science wiped out teleology in the last century. You would simply not permit it to ask what was a proton for, or what what was a hydrogen molecule for. But when you get around to discussing something in terms of evolution, you can ask, what is it for? So what's pain for? And immediately one gets trivial answers. In fact, it is absolutely clear when you think about it, even certainly your own experience, pain is clearly to do with two things, and really quite separate. It's to do with escape, avoidance. That's one aspect. The other aspect is to do with getting better, to do with recovery. You've all experienced that, twisting an ankle, slipping off a curb. You first feel a sharp cutting sensation right at the ankle, and associated with yanking your foot away, ouching, etc. But that sensation dies down very rapidly and is replaced with a quite different feeling. It's deep, it's poorly localized, it's spreading. When you feel that, you know you're in trouble the next day, maybe the next week. And what do you do with that sensation? Something completely different from pulling your ankle away. You don't move your ankle, and you don't let anybody else move your ankle. And it becomes tender, and the whole foot becomes useless. What's that about? That's the best tactic for recovery. So immediately, we're going to be dealing with two possible functions. So, having said that, let's now consider the other thing that you would look at, looking at something in context. What is injury, the response to injury, like in animals? And here's this astonishing 2000 BC bas relief from the lion hunt, which is the Nineveh wall in the basement of the British Museum. And here's a lion who is, by the way, paraplegic. This spear has gone through the spinal cord. You've got paralyzed hind legs. And the lion is perhaps rather brilliantly demonstrating, doing what you would expect, trying to escape, fully alert, fully mobilized, and concerned with escape. It's aroused, and so on. Here's a more recent picture. Stubbs, this is in the Tate, horse being eaten by a lion. And here you see again the spectacular arousal, alerting, orientation, moving to identify what is this stimulus. Now, and here we have a rather charming picture, 100 miles north of Bangkok, in a town, tribe of monkeys, macaque, have taken over the telephone wires for their evening amusement. And they all pour in there and muck around being monkeys. And as you can imagine, in such an old place, some of those wires, the insulation's off. so every now and again, monkey gets a shock, fair-sized shock. Now something interesting additional happens. That monkey doesn't touch that area again, and nor do any of the others. So we've got learning and an infectiousness of this experience in there. Now, you've all seen this. In what always strikes me as being utterly bizarre, you've got a field full of animals, pigs, let's say, And they've strung a single wire around that, and with a car battery and converter on it. You never see a pig touch the wire. And in fact, when they first put them up, one pig does touch the wire, gets back, the rest don't touch the wire. And you, if you look at the mess they've made in the field, they've churned up the field. They don't get within a snout's distance of this wire. Extremely effective and infectious. So good that in South African game reserves, they put wires like that around 30, 40 miles of protection. And none of the animals appear to approach the wire. Elephants, lion, certainly the monkeys, certainly the gazelles, all shear away. Very impressive. The leopards are the only ones who know how to cope with it. They jump over. But the rest of them have moved into this category. Now, so far you say, okay, along with Descartes, you could say, all right, this is a mindless mechanical process in which certain reflexes, certain mechanisms have been built in. But let's move on. Now I'm going to talk about horse racing. I don't know if you can see this all right, but anyway, this is the end of the 1980 Derby. And this horse, this one, is called Henbit, not a very good horse, is beginning to break away from the pack. And here it is, and I think this is the horse who's now out in front and going to win the race. And I picked this because that leg, which he's taking full weight on, is broken. About 200 yards before this, he stumbled in a pothole and broke a small bone in the front leg, cannon bone. Jockey heard it go. What does the horse do? He races away from the rest of the horses. Very odd. At a spectacular speed, leaving the rest behind. And here you see Henbit in the paddock, now beginning to look a little bit shaggy. The jockey is jumping off, and in the film you can see he runs down to that leg and feels over the leg and spots that it's broken. Very strange. This is no mechanical animal. So the next day's Daily Telegraph says this: courageous Henbit's career may end with Derby triumph. So, of course, the first explanation is it's courageous. That's why it would do it. It was obliging the punters or the owner or with a horse version of a stiff upper lip. But look at the rest of this thing. Here is a horse now worth many millions of pounds with a minor fracture. You can buy a lot of veterinary care for a few million pounds. And this fracture heals perfectly. They never get the horse up to speed again. Cry for Henbit, spent fine time at the stud. But here's an odd thing. A period of clear injury, obvious injury, major injury, well, major minor injury, in which for a period, far from ignoring it, he seems to do better than normally. This ain't no mechanical clockwork mouse. And Henbit's not the only horse who's been seen doing this sort of thing. King Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden in the 17th century was shot on this horse fighting the Poles and Russians and killed. The horse was also shot. There's a fair-sized shell injury here. So this horse, doing all the right things for a Scandinavian horse, now carries the dead king off the battlefield and carries him to the Baltic coast, whereupon the horse dies. The Swedes are so impressed that they take the king and the horse back to Stockholm, stuff the horse, and he now stands in the stables under the palace in Stockholm. Odd business here of a horse not doing the expected thing. And what's going on here? Just while we're on the subject of horses, I rather like this picture. It's also 16th century Chinese. It's an acupuncture chart for horses. And they, if you go to any posh racing stable now, they know all about acupuncture. They acupuncture horses. What's that for? Very odd. Now, I could and will lecture on acupuncture, but I will simply move on. That you see, here are animals doing rather odd things in the presence of injury. Now, this picture is taken, which you're very familiar with. There are three pictures in a row here. But at this point, Reagan is shot with a 9mm bullet through his right chest. He knows the shooting going on because he's seen his press attaché have a full head injury, and he's heard the shooting. And in this picture, they're pushing him into the car. and the car screams off. In the car, he does not know that he's been shot. Now, some of you may have particular opinions about President Reagan, and all the same, it's somewhat surprising. He begins to feel poorly, which is not surprising because he's bleeding, arterial bleeding into his chest. And they zoom off to the hospital. He's almost unconscious by the time he gets to the hospital. Of course, the details are all fully recorded. The only statement known from Reagan was that he asked the surgeon who was to operate on him whether he was a Republican or not. However, we have here again this strange appearance of a human being, clearly capable of pain, shot, severely injured, and not knowing it, and discussing in the car whether he was feeling bad because they'd slammed him into the car door. So we've got a strange phenomenon here occurring both in people, or one person, and in animals. This picture is of a fight which led to the Shia Sunni division amongst the Muslims. This sword, which was given a name, they were so impressed with it, is in the Topkapi Palace. This man is reported to having thrown the leg at this man. Now, here's a paradox. And one tends then to how do you treat a paradox? Of course, you say it's something very rare. Hopefully so rare that I don't need to have to think about it. Or it only happens in battle, or something of that sort. Simply not true. I'm sure there are many people in the audience here who actually have experienced this themselves, had an injury of some sort which they didn't notice until after. So let us now ask, what's going on here? Here are normal people overtly injured. We know that the peripheral nerves will certainly be firing off, sending in maximal messages. And yet, they carry on doing something else. Now, we had a look, were sufficiently puzzled by this and the high rate of it, which we had seen in military casualties. We just went to our own emergency room and asked people coming in from the ordinary accidents of a city, falling off ladders, road accidents, fights, and we asked people that we could talk to, i.e. not head injuries and so on. 40% of them said, "Doctor, you won't believe it, it didn't hurt." So this is a very common occurrence with... Now, what's going on? There are all sorts of trivial answers. People say, "Oh, well, they've mobilized their endogenous opiates." Maybe. Good luck to them. Still doesn't explain what is happening and how it can happen instantaneously with the injury, which they're fully aware of and describe in neutral terms, thinking of amputees, speaking of bangs, blows, thumps, and being aware that their leg or arm had gone, and yet not reporting pain. What's happening? Well, I think I can ask you. I think what is happening is that we are continually sampling the entire world available to our sensory systems. And somewhere inside us, non-cognitive, not talked about, we are selecting what's most important, and that attracts our attention. Now we can bring cognition into it. I think what was happening in all of these cases that I've just been talking about was that something more important was happening and was attracting attention. And now we have this rather odd business. These people are pain-free for minutes, hours sometimes. They all become, appear in pain, serious pain, appropriate pain, but later. You see, the suggestion is that they've moved then from an emergency period where there was something other than avoidance, escape, and so on, which was the most urgent matter. Later on, the most urgent matter is treatment and recovery, and now the pain occurs. So something to do with attention, which would evidently show itself in people and in animals. Now, what there's immediately a real problem here. Attention. Here we've got these wonderful brains. Can we really only pay attention to one thing at a time? Now that would appear to be the case. Why? And again, the common answer to that is that you've got so much information which you could process that you've got to limit it, because the otherwise the brain would be swamped with all the available information. So it chooses. No doubt it chooses. But we're left with the question, is that a reasonable explanation for attention and one attention? Obviously you can switch your attention from one thing to the other. But the odd thing is, at any 1 second, you only pay attention to one thing. Now we'll come back to that later on, but let's now simply follow that and ask, well, are there any signs of pain being associated with attention? And there are very exciting things happening right now, which include imaging of the brain, in which now with the spinal cord here feeding this information in the thalamus and cortex, of course, huge debate, okay, which parts become active? And as soon as imaging became available, it was obvious that pain would be a fascinating candidate, and immediately people started looking at pain, subjects in pain, volunteers given a painful stimulus, what part of their brain lights up? And to people's astonishment, a bit of the brain that nobody had ever heard of in medical school, called the anterior cingulate, was repeatedly reported, team after team, kept on saying, the anterior cingulate lights up. What's this anterior cingulate? It's here's the lateral part of the brain, and here you slice it down the middle. Here is, right down deep here in the middle, is this cingulate gyrus, swan, like a swan's neck, is why it's called that. And people said, ah, okay, classical predictions were wrong, but now we've found the pain area. And then all sorts of experiments were done. Here's this particular area, and here were a whole series of experiments done to do with pain and so on. But of course, people were asking all sorts of other questions, like what happens if you talk, or what happens if you move your eyes, all sorts of things that people would naturally be interested in seeing what was going on in the brain. And all of them kept on lighting up this same area. What's going on here? That's ridiculous. Except when you tried deliberately switching the subject or patient's attention. And sure enough, this is an area which is deeply locked in with attention. And not surprising, considering what I'd said, or what you all know, that of course if the person was going to report pain, then they would deliberately, previously, have to have started to switch attention to whatever they were going to report. and so there was one matter. Now, which appeared as soon as imaging occurred. Now, people, of course, began looking elsewhere in the brain, in addition to this anterior cingulate, and began to go deeper and look more carefully. Now, on this issue, I'm happy to say that there are a large number of people, particularly dealing with sensory psychology, sensory neurology, who are beginning to see that Cartesian prediction of first a sensory area lighting up is obviously not true. And you've obviously got to think of something a little bit more subtle than that. It's fascinating to see the way in the different disciplines, people are moving away from Descartes to more subtle approaches. There's an excellent book called Going Inside by John McCrone that's just come up, which shows that shift away from this classical, rigid, line-labeled structures into more dynamic matters. But so let us look a little bit here. Now, these are now PET scans. The ones I will show you happen all to come from Stockholm. In this particular case, these were patients with having an intense headache, a cluster headache. Where was it active? Here is that area.
that we expected. We just said it's lit up. But look here, here are the frontal lobes, here's the motor cortex, and here is insular, another piece of brain never mentioned in medical school. And so here's an area in the parietal cortex less active than normal. You can see here a real richness begins to appear. Here's one, these are actually experimental subjects. Here again is this attention area lit up. And then the various scattered areas. The thalamus is lit up, and frontal lobes, etc. And motor cortex. Now, here's one, these are people in intense pain as a result of a chronic nerve injury. Here's a favorite area. And we see the motor area, sensory area, yes, but the motor area and expanded into other motor areas. Very odd. What's the motor area doing active? These people aren't moving, they're just lying there. They've been in pain for months, years in some of them, and lying there, yes, they're in pain. Stationary, relaxed, the motor area. And look here, that's the cerebellum. Cerebellum is active. Nobody ever said the cerebellum had anything to do with sensation. It's something to do with the motor system. Okay. Now, during these studies then, to begin with, apart from this attention area, which I think, I hope we've seen expected, and apart from scattered areas, including the sensory areas, but including the motor areas, and cerebellum, and the basal ganglia. Now that's another group of structures which had no previous allocation at all to the sensory system, but had to do with motor systems. And now a very big question comes up. You see what's gone on historically, and obviously starting certainly with Aristotle, was the attempt to build a stepwise analysis and labeling of structures in the nervous system, in which you would have, in the case of Descartes, first pure sensation, and then the mind would start looking at it and deciding whether it liked it or not. In other words, the real dualism of separation between pure sensation, no cognition, permitted to animals, followed by the mind assessing in a cognitive way and absolute specialty of man with no other matter involved. Now, this imaging business comes more and more elaborate. Previously, the pictures that I showed you before were done with radioactive imaging, and now a new method appears, functional nuclear magnetic resonance, which is somewhat cheaper, considerably safer, no radioactivity involved, and excellent resolution both in space and time. And the results are just beginning to appear with that. And let me show you here the first paper. This is now from Toronto, Davis and friends. And they took 12 trained subjects and did exactly the same thing to them, including giving them painful hot stimuli. And they then scanned the brain as to where it was active. And they did various other things, touched, cooled, warmed, cold, pain, and hot pain. And they, after the method, looked in the various areas, including the basal ganglia. and including the areas which I've already mentioned. But now they could look at individuals. And sure enough, if you pulled these individuals together, you saw what had been seen with the with the PET scanning. That is to say, scattered activity, including motor areas, such as the basal ganglia. But the real astonishing result here is that no one subject is the same as any other subject. That's why the scattering of dots here. They were all in pain, but they were not showing the same pattern of brain activity. Now, you can imagine that that's a total nightmare for the classical thinkers. And in fact, raises the question of a private sensation in which only socially do we say to each other, I'm feeling pretty unpleasant, I'm going to call it pain. But what you're actually feeling could be somewhat different between people. Now, if you say that to a scientist, they're horrified. Of course, if you say it to an individual, they say, oh, I knew that all along. And in fact, in your ordinary experience, one of the great horror experiences of the army was to see a long line of men being vaccinated. They're all going to get an identical stimulus. And what did they do? Of course, some fainted, some whistled, some shouted at the nurses, some sang, some got totally tense, some played the fool, etc. Their response to an identical stimulus was highly variable. Some denying, some accepting, some reacting, some not reacting, etc., etc. So maybe it's not all that surprising that you see a variation, but what is it that's varying? And here I come back then to this question of the the motor system. Could it be that what is happening is that the people are developing tactics for how to respond to this and making what is, amongst other things, a motor pattern? So that it could be that something like this is going on. Sensory inputs may be analyzed, classified, and identified by premotor systems in terms of the motor actions which are relevant to the input. Now, how about that? Does that help to explain anything? And let us go back to this question of attention and the odd business that you can only pay attention to one thing at a time. Something inside you selects what is biologically most important for you at that moment, and switches attention, gathers information about that thing. Now, supposing that that analysis is in terms of what you might do about it. Now, there's one rule which is for sure. You can only do one thing at a time. You may not go forwards and backwards simultaneously. You can't turn right and left simultaneously. And it's part of the rules of doing something that you've got to choose one thing. And you see then why the attention monopolization could fit in with the fact that it's aiming at relevant action. Now, you can see that some of this comes out of the presence of paradoxes. Why, I said the paradox of the conscious person describing even their injury but not being in pain in certain circumstances. Well, there's another gigantic paradox, the placebo reaction. Here you get perfectly normal people who are expecting relief of their pain, and they're given a blank tablet and the pain goes away. That's ridiculous. By definition, the placebo is not a stimulus. It's a neutral matter. How can that change somebody's feeling? Well, that's a real puzzle, because again, this is a very common, very important matter on which I have written in that book quite a lot. But it leaves you with the problem, how do you even classify this placebo response, remembering that there are also equal numbers of nocebo responses, where something is done and you get worse, or the pain increases, or other things happen. And astonishingly, animals show certainly nocebo responses, and in fact placebo responses as well. So we can't just assign this paradox to our great wonderful brains. We've got to explain why rats show a placebo response. Now, it could be, of course, that while we talk about the placebo as a stimulus, it is in fact an action. It's something you do in the expectation that you're going to get better. Take a tablet, call in the witch doctor, whatever is your favorite placebo response. And again, this topic is being explored quite widely as people begin to realize what a devastating paradox it is. Bother to talk about pain unless you can also give some clue as to why a placebo reaction works. Now let me tell you something outside the range of pain, which has fascinated me. Recently, there's a paper appeared in the PNAS by Denton. And Denton is the world's expert on thirst. So, and in this paper, you'll see PET scans and all the rest of it. They have made normal subjects thirsty, but very, very thirsty, by injecting sodium chloride into them. And these were volunteers, and they marked off their thirst, and they got thirsty as hell. They were volunteers, they could stop at any time they wanted to. But they were brought up to maximum thirst, dry mouth feeling, so that thirst was the only thing of any importance. Their world was dominated by this huge thirst. Turns out not to be the dry mouth, by the way. This had been looked at before. If you moisten the mouth, yeah, it helps a bit, but not much. It's still thirsty. Right. Now you've got people all piped up, PET scanned, all the rest of it, and they say, right, that's it. They say, fine, okay. Here is as much water as you want to drink. And they gulp, gulp, gulp down water. Fine. And within 3 minutes, the thirst has completely gone. You say, fine, good, that's great. End of the experiment. But it's really only the beginning of the experiment, because they have hypertonic blood loaded with saline, which is undoubtedly triggering their thirst. In 3 minutes, they haven't had time to absorb several pints of water, which they need to absorb to dilute their blood down. The thirst has gone because they've done the right thing. They haven't shifted their biochemistry. So you see here, drinking in that circumstance is a placebo. It's an action. It's one of consummation, which has completed an act. It will eventually biochemically cure
what's wrong with their blood. But for the moment, they're fine. So you can see that there's a lot of reasons to think about pain in very new ways. I've given just two examples: why attention and why so peculiar. What's the placebo reaction? What on earth has that got to do with anything? The placebo reaction similarly can't be brushed away. It occurs with very severe pains, people with every reason to be in pain, and so on and so on. So let me follow almost at the end here with the last slide. Now that slide, you must admit, looks impressive. This data, I don't know what it is, but it's going to be good. And what is it? This is all the several hundred mammals. And this is the body weight, and this is the brain weight. Now, this ought to give you some sort of... And the answer is that the bigger the animal, the bigger the brain. Down here are the shrews, and up there are elephants, big whales, and so on. Well, so what? So why should a big animal have a big brain? And by the way, what's this slope here? Which is actually 0.75. What's that? See, it's not 45 degrees, it's 0.75. It's not the surface area. And this applies wherever you look. I mean, not just from shrews to whales and everything in between. And you say, but I thought we had a big brain. Well, we do. That's us. That one, yeah, that dot with the arrow on it. And by the way, the dot almost in the same place, the dolphins. So where's all this stuff about us having a big brain? Well, we do have a big brain in respect to our body weight, but only enough to put us that far away from the average. And you can see some really bizarre whales up here which don't have a big enough brain for their body weight. That's an elephant. Now, here's an odd thing. And it applies within species. Women have smaller brains than men. Why? Because they're lighter than men. Precisely along that slope. And you all knew that, really. You look around at dogs, all the same species, and there are Irish wolfhounds and Yorkshire terriers. They're all dogs, and they're all equally stupid or bright, but their brain weights are exactly on this line. It applies even to humans other than men and women. Nanencephalic dwarfs have brains half our size, but just because they're small. So what's that slope mean? That's got to mean something. If there was ever proper biological data, here it is. I mean, involving evolution with us in the middle. As I said, yes, we've got big brains, but only enough to move us that much away from the expected line. And when you see these comparisons of man and gorillas and chimpanzees and so on, they've factored out the body weight in order to show you how far away from from the expected weight you are, which you're permitted by your body. Okay. So what is this? It turns out that's your metabolism is strictly going along the same level, your basal metabolism and the amount of muscle movement that's possible. You see, one comes back
in this which I regarded as an absolute deep mystery, one comes back to the possibility that the brain weight has to do with what it's to do with, not where the information comes in. Well, let me simply finish by returning to this. You can see how trivial this this is. It's occupied scientists for a very long time to identify peripheral nerve fibers which were locked onto being only detecting pain and peripheral central pathways, and then presumably somewhere in the brain a pain center. Well, a great deal of therapy has been directed at trying to find that, and it's hopeless. I mean, hopeless. Most of the people made worse, certainly in surgical attempts to find these matters. The various therapies clearly do work, influencing the input, yes, in the case of things like aspirin, influencing the transmission, yes, in the case of things like morphine, but not at all describing the subtlety of what the whole mechanism is, which you can see by simply looking at the behavior. How are people responding to pain, and how are they, and how are animals responding to injury? So I think I will stop there. We're going to have a discussion, questions, and that's what I have to say.
Thank you very much for a very provocative and interesting lecture. And just on a personal note, I'm it reminded me of the pleasure of being back in England rather than in New York. When I at the New School last year told the students that women have smaller brains than men, I was reported to the dean. Anyone going to report that can see me later. But we will have questions now. There are two microphones available, and I think just signal to Dylan or Eva who have the microphones if you're this closer. Say who you are, if you could. Can I just make, I don't think the microphone's working, Dylan, is it? We need switching.
Well, I understand the question, which I can repeat. Could one see attention being used in surgery? But I'll come on to surgery. Look, the whole of the first basic folk medical treatment of pain is distraction. What's distraction? That's shifting the attention. Your child trips over the pavement, smacks into the pavement and starts crying. What do? You pick it up, shake it about, play the fool. You are trying to introduce a distraction, and a huge amount of therapy is distraction of one type or another, attempting to get the person's attention off what is dominating them and onto something less threatening. Now, you ask about surgery, and of course, this is exactly what has been done with hypnosis and various forms of hypnosis, which I would include in the general category of hypnosis operations under acupuncture. And because of the gate control theory, the Chinese were good enough to say that, in which we were saying that convergent impulses were important, they were good enough to say, aha, here are Western running dog capitalists who come up with our theory of acupuncture. So I was invited for a wonderful, real, red carpet treatment in China and was able to see acupuncture being done. Very impressive. Rare, but impressive. Sufficiently, they were using acupuncture needles commonly, but usually with a lot of other things which made it a little difficult to assess. But they were, we saw at least two operations of thyroidectomies which were 100% done under acupuncture with no other narcotics and so on. Okay, so here's a phenomenon. Can't brush it around. The fact that it's relatively rare is beside the point. Got to explain. What's going on there? Now, we saw successful operations, and we also saw unsuccessful operations. And that, by the way, was a problem which hit this city in the 1840s when a woman had a breast removed under hypnosis at University College Hospital and broke out of the hypnosis in the middle of the operation, sued University College Hospital and the doctor in the group of Esdale. So what's going on here? And we saw one of these examples astonishing in two ways. One is we saw a woman who was going to have a heart lung machine installed in order to operate on her heart. And I should say that, not speaking a word of Chinese, what we decided to do would be to follow patients from the ward through the entire procedure and back onto the ward so that we could really see what was going on. Here was a woman going to have a major operation. She had been admitted to the hospital some weeks before, and it was wonderful. The exact opposite of a British hospital where you're lucky to be able to be passed through the first swing door before you're thrown out again. They were admitting patients weeks before. They said, well, they had some tests to do it and discovered why these tests took all these weeks. But in fact, what would have produced an instant strike here, they were used as ward orderlies. They swept the wards and fed the patients breakfast and so on, and in the process became very familiar with the other patients and the staff. So you would see the people come into the operating room on their morning, and they were saying hello to everybody and chattering away. These people were familiar. They were familiar also with acupuncture. They'd been tried on acupuncture. These were skilled receivers of acupuncture. Okay. So now we see a man who goes through a prolonged operation perfectly. Great demonstration. Right at the end of the operation, they are going to put a drain through his chest. Immediately before sewing up, they're putting a drain into his chest. A standard procedure, very minor as compared with what it had happened. This man started screaming. They had to hold him down on the table, etc. What was all that about? They hadn't told him they were going to do it. That, the rest, they talked him through the whole thing stage by stage with the firm belief that he was not going to be in pain. An extreme example of that was seeing a patient who was also going to have an open heart surgery and brought into the operating room, and in order to get the machine up, they cut down onto her femoral artery in order to put in the catheter before starting the acupuncture. That woman was assured and believed rightly, in a sense, that she would not feel pain. So I think when you, my emphasis on attention may be excessive, because attention, after all, is a subject surprisingly little studied. What changes attention? But I would still say, yes, I would say that hypnosis is handing over to somebody else the authority to switch your attention.
How do you explain the pain of phantom limbs?
Well, you've got the world's great expert here in the audience, I see. It's interesting that Descartes was asked that question, actually by a marquise. And Descartes, because she could see that it was really a trap for Descartes. How on that matter would you? Descartes gave a very clever answer, being such a clever man. He said he essentially invented the idea of false signals. That is to say, he permitted corruption to occur anywhere along the pathway, something going wrong, so that a false signal would be generated. Okay, that's not the very clever idea. But the trap is the following. How come, if you've got such a brilliant brain, can you not detect a false signal and diagnose a false signal? So that, on that Cartesian idea, the mind is trapped in a capsule, can only read the dials on the capsule, and whatever they say is the truth. Now that's very embarrassing, although a lot of philosophers rather like that. That idea that that's all you've got to deal with, and you can't muck about with the sensory data, and there's no active matter in there. Now, I think there are two answers to your questions in advance of Descartes. And one is this: we've all experienced a phantom. When you go to the dentist and they block a quarter of your mouth, and you leave, they've done their business, you leave the dentist and you've got a numb lip. Now just think of that experience. It's a numb lip. It's not a hole in your face. Now the local anesthetic has prevented all nerve impulses from coming from that lip. But what you feel is, first, attention getting. And secondly, you feel a swollen lip, and you keep poking at it and looking in a mirror at it. The absence of signals arriving, the brain has detected that the normal news is not arriving and has turned on to say, something is odd in that region. Send me information about that region where I'm now directing attention. And I think that is one aspect of the non-painful phantom. It is absolutely clear that apart from that procedure, that the brain is creating a scheme, a sensation, in expectation and demanding information from the area. Now it is also clear that as time goes by, there are a whole cascade of changes taking place from the cut end of the nerve, and not just by nerve impulses, but by chemical transport, which change the whole pathway into the central nervous system. All of them demanding, I'm not getting the news, send me more information. And the consequence of that is that the cells along the transmission pathway become more and more excitable. which created the phantom in the first place, when they go far enough, they start firing spontaneously, and you're in a painful situation.
I'm very puzzled about the placebo response from an evolutionary point of view. And a particular puzzle is that it seems to involve a third party, or at least someone outside oneself, to give one the faith that this is going to work. That means that, from an individual fitness point of view, someone else has to be involved in wanting me to get better. And basically, my survival has become dependent on someone else's, the cooperation of someone else. It would have been much more effective to allow placebos to have worked in some sort of autocatalytic way, which made one basically trust in one's own faith that everything was going to get better, and not to have required this loop outside oneself. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think now we have to go back to animals. Rats are very difficult to poison, because they're so smart that they spot poisonous food. And that's how the nocebo response in rats was first noticed. It amounts to one trial learning. The animals were put in a cage, given a subcutaneous injection of apomorphine, a vomit-making stuff. And for some minutes, the rat sits there looking unhappy, if I may use such an expression, drooling, hair stands up on end, and it sits there. And eventually the apomorphine wears off and the rat goes about his business. Right. 3 months later, take that rat, put him in the same cage, inject the same amount of saline, and he goes through the same performance. Now, I think that's smart. He has learned that this is dangerous, and what he did before actually recovered. Now, I don't see why that couldn't be continued. We are humans. We're all babies locked into our mothers and then to our helpers and doctors and whatnot. Of course we involve a third person. Why do you think? I think our day is full of placebo. Starting with coffee in the morning. What on earth is that doing? It's absolutely essential. Can't get out of the bed without a cup of coffee. And so on and so on. And you know, you feed them decaffeinated coffee, they're just as good. They may complain about the taste, but the effect is the same. The tremor from decaffeinated coffee is the same in a double-blind test as from caffeinated coffee. So I do agree that when we have a problem, we naturally, rightly, thank goodness, turn to other people. I think before that we've had a crack at our own solutions, many of which are surely placebos.
I have a question about I have a question about a very curious clinical phenomenon which I'm sure you know about, called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, or RSD, where a person has a very trifling injury, maybe a small fracture or sometimes even an insect sting, but progressively the arm gets immobilized and extremely painful, sometimes actual bone changes and skin changes. And it's always been suspected there are central factors, maybe even psychological factors. What is this phenomenon? Do you have any speculation, and is it related to phantom pain?
Well, first let me tell you, going back to horses, that horses have this. Of course, since they're looked after by vets, they have a completely different history. It's called navicular disease. And why is it called navicular disease? Somewhere in the wrists of horses, whose anatomy I don't even know, they've got the equivalent of wrist bones, one of which is called the navicular, which looks like a boat. So what happens is horses, not necessarily injured, some of them have injured or stumbled, start hobbling. And they x-ray them, and they have a tender foot and a decalcified wrist bones. And in fact, the thing is pseudex atrophy or causalgia or whatever you like, just exactly as you described. So it's not special to humans. And as we know in humans, as you know better than I, it occurs at all ages, in children and old people and proper people. Now, we're not dealing with certainly a cognitive disease in the ordinary sense of the word. By the way, I should tell you what the horse people do about it. It's horrific. You know, they really don't give a damn about their horses. They just want another race out of them. What they do is they call in the vet and they completely denervate the area. So the animal has a completely numb foot and stops limping, since it can't feel its foot anyway. And then they can get a few more races out of it, during which time it develops a Charcot joint and becomes useless. But they're going to shoot the animal anyway. So, I mean, that's just the delicacy of veterinary treatment of these beautiful animals. We're not dealing with a unique human condition or even of a particular age. It is clearly a mystery, as again you know better than I, where apparently identical trauma may or may not be followed by the conditions that you described. And it's a hugely important mystery, because things of that sort are undoubtedly the worst intractable pains at the moment.
I was thinking, when you showed the picture of Ronald Reagan, that when it comes to serious injury, isn't the ability to be distracted a risky evolutionary strategy?
Well, of course, maybe. That's almost an ethical question rather than an evolutionary question. But what the initial assumption that I have is that you're somewhere in your brain, you're sorting out what is the optimal tactics to take for biological survival. You might think that either quitting or running away is the best thing to do, biologically best thing to do. It may not be. I think that's difficult to tell. But that's why I think that this question of what are the actual processes that go on that initially attract attention are extremely important. And there are and there's surprisingly little done on it. I see Richard Burton sitting over there, who's an architect, who is very much concerned with hospital architecture. And the question, what is it that makes a patient feel good, or anybody feel good? And by the way, it's clear that rate of recovery is better if the patient, quicker, if the patient is feeling good. What is this feeling good? If you, as he has done, for example, look at a landscape and you say, ah, what a lovely landscape, makes me feel good. You may say that, but it just sweeps over you. This is a non-cognitive, mindless, in a sense, reaction that you have to particular things. And here one thinks of attention as being something all to do with
once the attention has been grabbed, then you can do all sorts of clever talking about why it is that it grabbed your attention. But the amazing thing is, it happens in the first place, just like that. You look around at a group of faces, one of them you find attractive. You have the foggiest idea why, but it's something in your filtering system that said, oh, that's a pleasing face. And I think this is something very real, which has simply not been studied. It's just a fact. People say, why study it? You'll spoil it.
Yeah. I wonder if there is any reputable scientific explanation of stigmata, or are they just charlatans? Hmm.
That's a very important question. There is actually, not long ago, in Psychology Reviews, a big review on stigmata. It's an important question because of the following. We're all aware that we can change our bodies and we can dilate our pupils and blush and do all these things. But the impressiveness of the stigmata would be if you can actually, by whatever means, control, let's say, the palm of your hand in such a way that it becomes red and bleeds. So it's one of the reasons why it becomes such an important question. Do we have an autonomic, sympathetic nervous system which is so localized that we can do that? And that's, I would say, we don't actually know. The outcome of this review on stigmata was that they said non-proven. They were not clear of any of these wonderful demonstrations that they were not self-induced or old lesions or things of that sort.
I very much like many aspects of your argument about the importance of attention to action and why that prevents pain. Given that a structure like the anterior cingulate is the amount of activation is varying greatly from one instant to the next, and that you can, under certain circumstances, do multiple things, which increases activation of anterior cingulate, and also that some types of stimuli, for instance, lights, tend to autonomously or exogenously attract attention. I find it somewhat implausible that in, for instance, the battlefield cases, that you could explain the absence of pain for, say, a couple of hours or something of that sort in the face of a structure that will tend to respond very rapidly, normally, to painful stimuli, and which is very flexible in what it's being orientated towards. Why, in that two-hour period, are you not getting attention drawn to these very strong sensory inputs?
Well, the quick answer to that is you are. This was, Beecher showed this, really one of the first reports on battle casualties. He pointed out that here were these men coming in, Ansio Beecher, hugely serious injuries, enough to be admitted to hospital. You had to be fairly sick for that to happen. And they asked these people, are you in pain? Do you want something for it? And to his astonishment, 70% said no. Okay. Now they did the next obvious thing. They set up a drip. Sticking the needle in, they complained about. And I've seen this myself. It's, in other words, the analgesia is totally specific to the original episode. You start adding to it. I saw this of a man with an amputated foot, which wasn't serious, life-threatening or anything, lying
very well the drip up, and which already restricts your movement. Not complaining. I kept on saying, "Isn't it open? No, it's all right." The man develops a cramp in one leg. Ridiculous. Bit of massage and the cramp goes away. You see how specific the analgesia is with respect to whatever produced the injury. Where I would say, in this case, first this fellow had to get out of his injured situation. He was saying all sorts of things. There goes my holiday. What a fool they'll think I was to let this happen. And things like that. This man was rehearsing the whole episode of the accident and what to do. Cramp in the leg, that's got nothing to do with that. He can complain of that. I think that just shows the subtlety of the attention mechanism.
One quick question. Thanks, about 1950, Warren McCulloch, the mathematical biologist, developed a model for coarse algebra, which you probably are familiar with it. I wonder if this might be analogous to an explanation for phantom limb pain. The idea that it can, cause of the trouble can actually migrate slowly into the central nervous system by recruiting local groups of neurons.
You enormously embarrassed me, because Warren McCulloch was my second boss, and I never knew what that he proposed that.
In his anthology of Embodiments of Mind,
I better read it.
We've reached half by something we should put to the present. It's just been hard to connect Pat's remarks about action to the fact that there never was a philosopher who could bear the toothache patiently. I think it must be the philosophers that are still really bad at developing better plans. Thank you, Pat. It's been a very interesting evening.